This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Welcome to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs. My guest this week, Cleo Doyle, podcaster, academic, lecturer, and writer. We discuss whether the phenomenon that is Taylor Swift is also worthy of study as literature. Join us for our discussion.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Cleo Doyle. Cleo holds a PhD in English and Renaissance Studies from Yale University in the USA. She's a lecturer in early modern literature at Queen Mary University in London, where she's also designed a module on Taylor Swift. She's also won awards, the 16th Century Society English Literature Prize and the Yale University Theron Rockwell Field Prize. Cleo, welcome to Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me, especially as last week we attempted an abortive attempt to record something and it didn't work. You are a podcaster, you're an academic, you're a PhD in English literature. And of course, as I said in the introduction, you have written about and you're preparing to write even more about Taylor Swift and why we should consider Taylor as a subject of English literature, worthy of English literature. How do people react when you say, I do a podcast on Taylor Swift, I'm an academic, and I think we should study Taylor Swift?
I will say they're either very excited or they're not excited at all. There's a real dichotomy. But I think that there are a fair number of people who really, really love Taylor Swift and want to know more about her work and want her work to be studied. And so I get a fair number of very positive reactions. And then also some people who think that she shouldn't be studied by academics.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the reaction, the positive reaction of people like fans of Taylor Swift and so on, are there people also saying, I see where you're coming from, I've listened to her songs and there's something to be studied here, something important. Do you get that reaction as well? They are literature.
Well, something that really interests me about Taylor Swift is the fact that she has such a large community of fans who are already close reading and analyzing her songs in a way that feels really close to what we ask students to do in literature departments in universities. And so I think that people are already reading the songs as literature. I just think that my role is one, well, I want to join in because I'm really interested in her work. But two, I think that something I can offer is to almost sort of validate the way in which people are already reading that and to show them ways that we read texts in English departments that could even sort of broaden their understanding of Swift's lyrics.
You're using Taylor Swift as a kind of entry drug. You want to study Shakespeare and Chaucer. You know, that's a bit difficult. So I think you're suggesting, you're quite rightly, I think, that Taylor Swift's lyrics are worthy in their own right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first off, I suppose I'm not sure that it is easier to study contemporary popular culture than it is to study Shakespeare, for example. And I say that because I think often what that requires you to do is to sort of separate yourself from your current context and from everything you know about Taylor Swift as a public figure, and to try to sort of engage with her lyrics as texts and her writing as texts. And that's often a struggle. That's something that I find that my students often struggle to do, is to say, okay, I'm going to approach this as a literary text and use my skills to try to get meaning out of it in that way. I mean, obviously, I teach Shakespeare and Chaucer as well. And so I know that there are difficulties there with kind of understanding the context of the early modern theater or reading Middle English. And we don't have that with Taylor Swift. But I do think that we do have the difficulty of almost being too saturated in the moment to really engage with her text.
Well, the thing about Taylor Swift is that people have lived her life alongside Taylor Swift. Her songs are drawn heavily upon her life. So you say, oh, well, that's about that boyfriend. My daughter said this to me. She said, well, you've got to understand that this is about this relationship that broke down. This is about this incident that took place. This is about struggles with record companies or something like that. And you think, well, does that get in the way of the text? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, there's a line in Shakespeare's As You Like It that is understood to sort of be a reference to the death of Marlowe, who was this huge, you know, literary influence on him. So I think with all writers, we know that their texts are reflecting aspects of their lives, often in ways that are deliberate. But I think one of the things that I ask my students to do with Taylor Swift is that I show them some sort of contemporary internet pieces that are doing exactly this, that are saying the scarf in her song All Too Well that she says she lost at a boyfriend's house represents her virginity. And so I ask the students, do you think that this is a good way of reading to say that this scarf in this, and we sort of talk about why this might or might not be an interesting way of reading a text. And we talk about what it might mean to separate the biography of the author from the text itself and why we might want to put it back in. Because sometimes it's really important to know that Taylor Swift is this very famous young white woman who's writing these texts. And sometimes it's useful just to read them kind of as words on a page.
You could say, well, actually what I'm going to do is do a sort of meta, look at the, we're standing back from that and saying, here we have the problem of the author and the text and the relationship between them. So that's a way of thinking about that.
You know, often we have only one text of a play and we know there were errors that were made in printing it. And we know, you know, sometimes for the plays that only exist in the first folio, which was put together after Shakespeare's death, we know that people were just sort of, you know, printing some version of his plays that might not have been the version that he wrote. And so I think that we always need to step back and think, how are we doing this before we actually do it in terms of English literature, at least?
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
You are listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs on Teachers Talk Radio. And my guest, Dr. Cleo Doyle, as we discuss teaching Taylor Swift. That's a good way in which I can go back to in a way where I wanted to start this podcast until I thought of something else. And that is, what are we doing? What are teachers doing? What are you doing? What I do? I taught English literature for a bit. I mean, my main subjects were history and other things, but I did teach it for a bit. And when I asked myself, what's the purpose of that? In a sense, we all read. Why not just say to students, read. That's all you need to know. And you make of it what you will. So what are we doing when we study English literature?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And there's when you go on the academic job market, there's always a moment in the interview when they're hiring you for a job that's mostly teaching Shakespeare, where they ask you, why should we teach Shakespeare? And sometimes I do sort of feel that plunging sense of like, oh, I don't know, you tell me. But no, I think the reason that we study literature at the university level is because we're taking literature as something that can tell us about the past. So often if we're teaching quite old texts, it's a way into the past in a way that we might not get if we're looking at, for example, architecture or paintings or the records of battles, right? These are all things that can give us some kind of insight into historical periods, but literature is another one. Of course, that's not the only reason. And I don't, you know, I'm not sitting around reading Middlemarch thinking this is giving me such a great insight into the past. I'm thinking this is such a wonderful story. And so obviously there are other elements to why we read literature. But I think that for me, the thing that I want my students to do is ask the question, right? And think, what is this poem telling me about the world, about the past, about myself?
It's not a bad justification, actually. I mean, if we had to start with that, you say it's only one reason you might read, but it's a good one, is that you can get an insight in lost words. You know, the past is another country. You can't know what people were thinking really when you're in the past, but you might get an insight into it through the Victorian London, through Dickens, even strip out the sentimentality and so on. You get the idea of the things they were worried about and what it was like and so on. That's actually Chaucer's. You know, anyone who's come across any Chaucer will suddenly go, oh my goodness, they were actual people. They were a bit rude and they fell in love with each other and out of love with each other and they were jealous. I mean, they were just like us, and that's hard to grasp sometimes. So that's not, I mean, you know, I mean, the trouble with, in a sense, you, if you're sitting in a room and say to students, you're studying Shakespeare and someone says to you, why? You say, well, you know that at least part of the reason is because you're British or English, and this is an English classroom, and mm-hmm. that's part of your heritage, isn't it? And mm-hmm. that sort of can be a bit worrying in a way, because you think, well, there is that sense in which I'm trying to build a cultural identity. I don't know, yeah. Is that a worry? I don't know if that worries us.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as an American, I feel that worry less intensely because I know that I'm studying a foreign country for me. But yeah. I do think when we start at the beginning of the Shakespeare survey, I teach on at Queen Mary, we usually have some kind of lecture where we talk to students about that. And we say, why is Shakespeare such a big deal, right? Why are we teaching you Shakespeare? And we talk about the constructedness of the canon, which is to say the way in which people came to think that certain books and authors were worth studying. And we talk about the history of the universities and sort of the way in which the study of English sort of came about in the 19th century to prepare people for the civil service. And we talk about that because I think that that's something that's really important to keep in mind is that disciplines don't just exist, right? You don't just sort of come to a discipline and it's always been the same way that it's always been, but disciplines are constructed and change over time for various reasons.
I mean, there must have been a time where, well, there was a time. I mean, I think Samuel Pepys didn't think much of Shakespeare. And yeah, you get this idea that what we think is great will change. There will be things added to the canon of English literature as time goes by and so on. And so our idea of the envelope, but of course, one of the reasons we talk Shakespeare in places like India and the Caribbean as in a colonial terms is to try and enculturate. So, you know, so all sorts of people in different parts of the world were studying Shakespeare to learn more, to be civilized, to put it bluntly. In that sense, I know that there's a background there where the working classes of Britain, you know, this is good for you. It's kind of like a medicine. You won't necessarily enjoy it, but it's good for you.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things that we've done is we taught Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and then we taught a play by a Black Frenchman called Aimé César that's called A Tempest, that's about talking back to The Tempest and calling it out for its colonial overtones. And that was a really fascinating text to read. And the thing is, we taught Shakespeare first, and then we taught them this text that had issues with Shakespeare and was transforming Shakespeare. And so I think, yeah, I mean, one of the reasons for studying Shakespeare, if we're going back to sort of that, you know, horrifying interview question, is so that people can understand the ways in which, for better and worse, his work and that of the people writing at the same time as him has shaped the cultures that we see today. And we can understand the way in which people have taken issue with it and sort of see it as students entering into a conversation, not just reading Shakespeare and thinking, yep, this is it. This is the best that anyone's ever written, but coming to understand some conversations that are still ongoing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could say, well, let's have a look at the way Shylock was portrayed and say, well, you know, how would you do that? How would you put that on the stage these days? Lots of assumptions in Taming of the Shrew. One song that jumped out, learning curve on Taylor Swift, was Love Story, which that's Romeo and Juliet, isn't it? I mean, there's references to Romeo and Juliet in it and the scene where Romeo and Juliet meet in the ball and so on. She's clearly playing with that in the song. So it's like a gift for any teacher. If you're doing Romeo and Juliet next term, there you go.
Yeah. And I think I remember one of my teachers when I was in high school teaching it in the English classroom, actually. So if we're thinking of Taylor Swift being taught in the English classroom, I think we can look back, you know, 10 years or more probably. That's a text that is very, very openly rewriting Shakespeare and improving Shakespeare. And you talked about changing the endings of Shakespeare's plays, right? Baudelaireization. And she's letting Romeo and Juliet supposedly live out this love story and be married and live happily ever after.
And also, one of the things that I think Taylor Swift does in her songs also is you can't tell whether she is Romeo in the song. Or like when I listen to it, is she Romeo? Is she Juliet? From which viewpoint is she talking as the song progresses?
That's a really interesting question.
is she Juliet or so on? And that would be really useful if you wanted to talk about literature generally, about where you're supposed to view the scene from.
But yeah, I mean, looking at the lyrics of the song, Swift seems to be initially sort of and mostly voicing Juliet, sort of speaking. Mm. And then we sort of get to these different moments where it feels like Romeo's voice is kind of breaking through, or it sounds almost like she's sort of saying a stage direction. You know, he knelt to the ground and pulled out a ring. And yeah, so I think it's a song that's very interested. I mean, reasonably, because she's adapting a play into a song lyric, it's really interested with speech and who's saying what. And so I think that that's a really good example of, you could easily dismiss that as well. Oh, well, you know, she's just rewriting Romeo and Juliet. She likes sentimental love stories. But actually, if you look at what she's doing, she's thinking in a very sophisticated way, I think, about who is saying what and who gets to tell what story.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to look at people just using Shakespeare's plots, just then any kind of hallmark romance on television, or boy meets girl, boy loses girl, and so on, boy meets the wrong girl, and it all ends up badly or well, depending. But this, so she's doing something much cleverer than that. Was she, I mean, this is where I'm going to display my lack of knowledge, but was Taylor Swift always this intently trying to write songs that were complex? Because she starts in country music, and there's a sense in which country music does have very simple tropes about, you know, love lost. And yet she's moved further than that. So would you say that you have pursued her development as an artist as well?
Well, you know, I feel like even the very early songs from her debut album are still working in interesting ways. The very early song, Our Song, and we found a lot of moments in it that we were intrigued and puzzled by in terms of its lexis or its word choices, right? What it's choosing, how it's choosing to say what it's trying to say. And so you could sort of make this distinction between the topic or the trope, right, or the story, and then how it's told, the style, the tone. And I think that she's always had a very interesting way of telling even quite simple stories.
Yeah, I listened to a song, trying to remember it now. It was something is one of them. He's either the name of the song. What he said, and I thought, well, it's a very universal thought, and the song is exploring something simple but very, very universal. Well, love and people you fall in and out of love with. Well, that's half of Shakespeare's plays, and 2/3 of literature, because those things are significant, and because we identify with them.
Well, yeah, it's also sort of much of life, I guess, is thinking about our relationships as well. But yeah, that's always, I think everyone sort of knows that Taylor Swift writes a lot about love and relationships. It's not all she writes about, but it's certainly kind of an enduring interest of hers.
And if you were exploring those things with school children or with students, there's a way in which literature is also, well, is literature good for you? is reading books and poetry actually going to give you a sense of, I don't know, mental calmness, happiness?
Yeah, calmness or happiness. I mean, I wish I could just prescribe a book and say, this will make you happy. You know, I think we all wish it were that simple. But I think ultimately, the more you increase the sum total of your knowledge and experience, and I think that that's a good in itself. I can't say that reading the lyrics to a few Taylor Swift songs will make you a better person. But I do think anything that forces you to sort of think about things in unexpected ways and sort of surprises you is ultimately helping you become a better thinker and engage with a wide range of texts. And so I think, you know, in universities, and I'm sure this applies throughout, we're teaching a very small, sort of minute speck of all that we could possibly teach, right? We're teaching, you know, 3 or 4 Shakespeare plays, and that's supposed to represent the experience of reading Shakespeare. And we're teaching, you know, a handful of Taylor Swift song lyrics and some academic articles, and that's supposed to represent the experience of reading Taylor Swift's lyrics as literature. But the thing is, really what we're teaching is an approach to any kind of study and the carefulness. You know, often I find my students think that they've understood it, and I'll ask them to summarize it, and they won't really have understood it at all. At the very basic level, they'll have missed some kind of vital detail. And so we'll work our way through kind of line by line. And I think that that process of spending time with something and putting sort of work into something is ultimately what we want students to do and what we want them to get out of their degree. Yeah. So yes, in a way, maybe.
And is, I don't know. You just made very eloquently another case for studying English literature. In other words,
so.
Literature is about the exploration of the most profound aspect of you humans, which is your language. and how other people use it. I mean, how do we reach across the void that's between us, except through words and language? So if you can read carefully, it could have all sorts of knock. You said it, initially you studied things because you were going to go into the civil service. You know, you had to know how to write essays and things. But in a sense, we're saying something bigger than that, that to study literature is to understand language more profoundly and more intricately, and maybe use it yourself.
Yeah, hopefully. And yeah. I do think that reading makes you a better writer as well. So yeah, I think so. I mean, I should have said that at the top of this interview when you asked me what the purpose of studying literature was.
Well, you did say there are all sorts of reasons for studying literature. And that's certainly true when I've ever put a poem in front of a group of students and said, let's look at that first line. And they don't get what it means, or they think it means one thing. And then you say, well, it could mean this and could mean this and could mean this. And we start to unpack it and so on. And also you sort of start talking about the sort of meta language of poetry, you know, similes and metaphors and so on. As then it becomes a way you can talk about, well, anything you read, really, isn't it? I mean, the study of English literature makes us better readers.
Oh, well, hopefully. I mean, I would say that that's probably the one thing that we can say it definitely does, because it forces you to engage in really sort of close ways with a text, right? To say exactly why you think you know what it means and to show evidence for that. And I think that that's sort of the underlying purpose of the whole discipline, is to try to figure out a way to understand what words mean when they're written down. Definitely.
Now, you're engaged in a project to write a book about Taylor Swift, and it's coming out in a couple of years.
Yes. How do you find it? It's a short book, so that's good for me and probably for any readers that I find with it. But yeah, so my publisher thinks it's the first work of literary criticism on Taylor Swift. And I agree. I haven't found anyone else who's written a book-length work of literary criticism on Swift. But yeah, it's essentially, I mean, it's an extension of my podcast. So if listeners want to know the sort of thing that I do, you can sort of listen to studies in Taylor Swift and that'll give you a sense of it. But yeah, it's essentially just sort of taking the texts of Swift songs and close reading them and analyzing them and figuring out how they work.
And it is that, isn't it? It's close reading and analyzing them, not this one means, this one is about her boyfriend. This is about her record company problems. This is about looking at the language itself, the words.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are all sorts of different ways of reading. There are different kinds of truth that you can look for in texts. And so you can look at a text of Taylor Swift's and say, I think this is about her record company deals. And you're probably right on one level, but I'm interested in understanding the formal elements of her work, how it fits together, what it's doing in terms of metaphor, imagery, style. So the kinds of things that we teach in English literature classrooms.
Like, well, another song I looked at was Cruel Summer. I think one of the most popular songs, actually, as far as I can tell. And it's full of fascinatingly complex phrases and imagery. I mean, I took a phrase that jumped out at me, wrote it down here. She says, there are no rules in a breakable heaven. I thought, well, you could write that on the board, couldn't you? No rules in a breakable heaven. Deconstruct that, if you will. From there, about the whole idea of the context of the song and that particular phrase. Or are there other songs you would say that are particularly good for the study of literature? I mean, not just Taylor Swift, but any particular songs.
Well, one that I think is very interestingly complex is Maroon from her most recent album that's not a re-recording. That's a song that I think about a lot, including on one episode of my podcast, but I feel like I haven't gotten to the bottom of it. And it's a song that kind of uses a lot of imagery that she's used before. So wine, stains, bruises, marks. And she has this whole sort of, I guess, kind of poetics of the kinds of damage that can be done to the body. And I think that that's sort of how I read that song. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Fair enough. Well, you can go back to it and look at the text, see if you agree with me then. But I feel that it sort of uses this imagery to sort of think about what it feels like to be within a vulnerable body, especially in the context of the difficult times that we've all lived through. I mean, the pandemic and everything else. But I think that what's really interesting to me about it is that it feels like it's trying to grapple with the kind of damage that's been done. And it feels to me like a really sort of difficult song in a way, in that I'm not sure that it's very optimistic, but I think a really sort of poetic expression of damage and vulnerability.
Yes, and I think when going back to my observation earlier, which was, should literature make you feel happy or good? Not really. I mean, I suppose I really meant was somehow heal the wound, you know, empathize with others. We're all going through this human experience together, but that can be quite unpleasant, really. I mean, all sorts of literature can be disturbing and unsettling. And she's not afraid of dealing with some of the things which are unsettling and troubling as well.
No, and I think that that's maybe something that people who haven't listened to her music very much don't know about her, because they might just have heard sort of the most popular sort of upbeat poppy songs like Me and We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. I think people maybe who haven't spent more time with sort of her back catalog don't realize kind of the range of emotions and styles and topics that she's gone into, especially in the last several years.
It is a problem when studying Taylor Swift, not just her life and knowing about her, but the image of Taylor Swift. I mean, immediately I can picture what Taylor Swift looks like. Mm-hmm. And along with most of the planet probably right now. She's probably just about one of the most famous people on the planet. And that's only happened in the last 18 months or so. And her recent tour, the mega money it's making and so on. She would certainly stop the traffic if she decided to walk down Oxford Street and cause a riot, probably. So it's very difficult to divorce her from massive celebrity, colossal riches that go with that. So in a sense, is she in danger of masking her own work because it's Taylor Swift? You know, she is bigger than her work.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I think we're certainly living in the midst of sort of this phenomenon where Taylor Swift is just everywhere. Yeah. And I mean, I feel that as an academic who teaches a class on Swift as literature, you know, a lot of people want to talk to me, you know, in the media just because I'm teaching Taylor Swift. And there is something that feels weird about that because no one was calling me up when I was working on early modern agriculture, you know, saying, I hear you write about farming and poetry or something. So yeah, I mean, it is a weird thing, but for me, it's interesting. I think it's really interesting that her work has kind of, and her life, I mean, together, have sort of captured the popular imagination in this way. And for me, that's one of the things I'm excited to sort of think and talk about right now, because who knows why something just sort of takes off and becomes this kind of popular, but clearly she's doing something for people. Like her work and her life are doing something for people right now. And it's really interesting to think about why and what that is, I guess.
Yeah, that we're living through a sort of shared experience of Taylor Swift in a way that the media wasn't supposed to do anymore. You know, that kind of, we're all watching our own separate things in our own little bubbles, but we've all heard of Taylor Swift. We're all familiar with her. She's a celebrity in every medium. It's a bit like when I was young in the 1970s and everyone watched a thing on telly. Mm-hmm. There aren't many moments like that now. It's a kind of shared cultural. So whatever, if you go into a class, I guarantee any teacher who goes into a class right now and puts a picture of Taylor Swift up on the screen or says, we're going to look at this particular song, they're going to get a reaction. They won't be like, who's that then?
It definitely is, yeah. And I think I feel a little bit conflicted about that as well, because I think, you know, in a weird way, I was sort of working on my podcast like three, four years ago, whenever, you know, it was most active. And it sort of felt like sort of a minor distraction. And I would talk to people about wanting to teach a class on Taylor Swift's literature. And they would go, oh, that sounds nice. But do you think anyone would be interested in taking it? Like, is that too niche a subject? And I think it's become this kind of overwhelmingly evidently popular thing. And it's very unexpected in many ways, at least to me.
Because there's always the feeling that what happens if there's a when things are stratospherically popular, there's often say, well, wait for the fall, it's uncool, or we've all had too much of Taylor Swift, so there's the danger that the trajectory of pop culture will suddenly drop away. And
that people are enjoying having something that everyone can kind of talk about and have an opinion about right now, at least.
And that would be a brilliant tool in the classroom, as I say, not just to grab attention. One of the things of introducing literature to students is often you are doing exactly that. This is a book you've never read. I remember being given a novel, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, in school. I thought, I didn't even know that existed. Never heard Thomas Hardy. Who's that? And that was being the teacher as the guide through the jungle. Here we are. Here's something you didn't know existed. But you might well be able to use Taylor Swift for something that students already possess, that they may have views that don't like the music, but they have it in their own world as well. And so you give them a certain empowerment, I think.
Well, and I will say it's a very strange experience from being someone who teaches medieval and early modern literature to then sort of walk into my Taylor Swift and literature classroom and realize I know the least about the subject I'm supposedly teaching than anyone in the room.
There's a lovely thing in the news this morning about the Victoria and Albert Museum that are looking for a Swiftie, a super fan, to advise the museum.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, the interesting thing about that is that, you know, they're calling for a super fan advisor in five different areas, and one of those is Taylor Swift. And so obviously the news media coverage is, you know, the V&A wants to hire a Swiftie, and they're sort of ignoring, you know, they're also hiring a super fan of like drag, and I forget what the other ones are. But it's interesting because Taylor Swift is clearly overwhelming everything else if Taylor Swift's name weren't in the mix, but that suddenly makes it news. So
yes, Mr. Gibbs, you liked Tony Hancock in the 1970s. Yes, I don't think anyone's interested really, but that is the moment we're living through. Anything that mentions Taylor Swift, but going back to the earlier part of our discussion, why is that in the news? Partly because the Victorian Albert, built by deeply Victorian principles of public improvement and the preservation of the best that can be thought and said, and now you're having some young personage going to come in and say, well, this is the thing you should keep, and so on. So it's provoking people in certain parts of Britain to say, well, why are they doing that then? That's not the proper thing to put in a museum.
Well, I think that it's very clear to me that Taylor Swift, especially the idea of Taylor Swift being taught at a university or her work being displayed at a museum like the V&A, clearly that brings up a lot of feelings for people about the relationship between high and low culture, or about the meaning of art. And so a lot of people's reaction will be, you know, no, that shouldn't be taught. This other thing that, you know, that I was taught growing up, or that I've always been told, is sort of the, you know, the highest kind of art that there is should be taught. And I have this whole thing. I'm really interested with the way in which Shakespeare's name gets sort of thrown into the conversation. The idea of me and other people teaching Taylor Swift at the university level comes up. And this is, I think you mentioned you read my piece in The Conversation about this, but I sort of looked at the news coverage of all of the different classes that were being taught on Swift. And whenever they could, the newspapers would say, this is being taught by a Shakespeare professor, or this Shakespeare professor thinks that. And I think that there's very much the idea of sort of the high validating the low, sort of someone who is an expert in Shakespeare, you know, the greatest poet and dramatist, to sort of saying, oh, Taylor Swift is pretty good as well. And I think that there is, it does bring out this kind of, I think often quite hidden kind of complex of assumptions about what's worthwhile and what's good art. So I think that's interesting.
So you won't be said, fan of Taylor Swift thinks. you will be the expert who's saying to us something that we might find a collision of worlds. So here's the world of academia, the expert. And here's the world of pop culture, which we don't think is superficial. And
popular culture sort of enters into academia. It sort of migrates, right? Because something that's sort of popular and looked down on, you know, several decades on, suddenly becomes the object of study. And you could look, for example, at horror movies or action movies. Or if you're thinking about cinema, right? Sort of things that were sort of looked down on then sort of become the preserve of like academic experts. And I think that's not always a good thing, but it's sort of like the way that subjects kind of evolve and that expertise evolves. But yeah, definitely. I think whenever I'm talking about Taylor Swift, I'm granted authority to do that in a way, or I feel like I've been granted authority to do that. But the fact I have this PhD in English literature, which really did not involve any kind of study of Swift. So I'm just sort of saying, yeah, I can read Swift because I was taught to read Chaucer or whatever. Yes. So yeah, it is a strange thing.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
You are listening to Teachers Talk Radio News, and here is a roundup of some of the main stories over the past 7 days. On the eve of the National Education Unions Conference, which runs in Bournemouth from the 3rd to the 6th of April, it looks increasingly as though a ballot on strike action will be taken. An indicative ballot, in which over half the members of the union participated, showed 9 in 10 in favour of a ballot on strike action. Daniel Kabedi, General Secretary of the union, indicated that if conference votes in favour of strike action, it would be serving notice to this government and future governments rather than ensuring that strikes did happen. However, he also outlined his belief in the gravity of the current crisis facing education in an interview with Radio 4's Today programme.
There is a mood of desperation, if we're being honest. The profession is very much on its knees. Morale is at an all-time low. And of course, we can see that in the crisis in recruitment and retention. 9% of the teaching profession left the profession last year prior to retirement. The government is continually missing its recruitment targets for new teachers. We missed it by 50% for secondary teachers this year. Quite simply, if we continue on this direction of travel, education will grind to a halt.
Other teachers' unions, including the NASUWT, have indicated they will not be holding a ballot on strike action. However, Patrick Roach, General Secretary of the NASUWT, has called for the replacement of the School Teachers' Pay Review Body, or the Independent Pay Review Body as it is known, with a Teachers' Pay Commission, stating that the current pay review body is not independent, since its remit is set by the government and its members chosen by the government. And this year, the pay review body has been told by the government that it must set a pay level lower than last year and focus on shortage subjects. In other news, this week, Amanda Spielman gave her first interview since leaving as head of Ofsted. On the Difficult Women podcast, she was asked by interviewer Rachel Johnson, while reflecting on her career, about the death of Ruth Perry. Much loved and dedicated head teacher Ruth Perry had committed suicide after an Ofsted inspection, which the coroner had characterised as brutal and insensitive. Spielman said that the inspection had been carried out exactly as it should be. There was nothing wrong with the inspection, but, she noted sadly, it is at times difficult to tell people tough messages. And she compared the Ofsted process with its single word, judgments, as being similar to a driving test, which no one likes to fail. This week, the website Teacher Tap, which regularly carries out surveys into teachers' attitudes and opinions, surveyed teachers' reaction to the Dame Sarah Kahn report into threats to public cohesion, in which she'd suggested the possibility of exclusion zones around schools of 150 metres. This came in reaction to groups of parents demonstrating outside schools in reaction to what they perceived as insults to religion among the staff. 58% of teachers surveyed thought this was a good idea. 48%, though, said yes, but the exclusion zones should not exclude teachers' unions or striking teachers. In another Teacher Tap survey this week, the website reported that over 20% of teachers had seen evidence of cheating using artificial intelligence. This was up from 6% last year. Teachers' views were also surveyed in an NASUWT poll that was reported in the Independent newspaper. In a survey of thousands of teachers, 9 out of 10 stated that stress and workload had had an adverse effect on their mental health, and 12% said they used alcohol to cope. In some powerful interviews, other teachers described vomiting before work and having cried at work in reaction to student behaviour. and stress. This follows the widely reported news item on the BBC, which said that one in five teachers in England had been hit by a pupil in the previous year, and teachers reporting that spitting, swearing, and chair throwing were happening often. This week, the website Education Uncovered, led by the investigative reporter Warwick Mansell, reported the story of Sir Paul Marshall, chair of the Ark Schools Academy Trust. Sir Paul, multi-millionaire hedge fund manager and co-owner of GB News, was reported by the organisation Hope Not Hate, which confronts hate speech in the media, as having retweeted, either casually or thoughtfully, a number of the most extreme Islamophobic and homophobic tweets. Union members at ARC Schools have called for him to resign, as no longer fit and proper to be associated with education. And Labour MP Sam Tarry has urged the ARC Trust to sever links with Sir Paul. So far, they are standing by him. And finally, in a widely reported story which appeared in The Guardian and on the BBC and in the Independent newspaper, parents at a Boyne primary school in Aberdeenshire were furious after the photographer, Tempest Photography, issued two sets of photographs of the children. One, where the pupils with additional needs had been removed. Parents received an apology from the local council, which said the decision had not been taken by the school and the link to the photographs had been removed. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news for this week. You can find archived interviews of Daniel Kabidi, the General Secretary of the NEU, in-depth discussion and analysis of the role of Ofsted in many past Teachers Talk Radio programmes, as well as the weekly teacher review on Sunday mornings on YouTube. Thank you for listening. You are listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs on Teachers Talk Radio, and my guest, Dr. Cleo Doyle, as we discuss teaching Taylor Swift. That way in which things of popular culture will graduate into high culture. And is there's a lot, probably a lot to be said about when that happens, and the resistance to it as well. There was an article in the Daily Telegraph, of course, which said something like Mickey Mouse degrees. And I thought, okay, what's the latest Mickey? This is a constant thing that will come up in the Daily Telegraph every year or two. But a university teaching something they don't think universities should teach. And this one was, well, it always gets clobbered, is media studies. So any kind of study of television or of popular culture would be seen as, to some extent, wasting your time at university. In a way that, if you said to the Daily Telegraph writers, we're studying Shakespeare and Chaucer and Milton and so on, they wouldn't. Oh, very good. That's just fine. But that wouldn't have always been true. And it's only a kind of value judgment that why I worry about that value judgment is it's not just conservatism. It's an attempt to preserve elitism. It was knowing about Taylor Swift and knowing about things that are difficult, more have a more minority status and understanding, is a way of limiting access to, well, power, I suppose. You know, there was the English literature degree that studies Milton and Shakespeare, because they will be more outside of your ordinary experience, will mean there's a higher to climb over to attain success. I mean, your PhD was in
English and Renaissance studies, yeah.
English and Renaissance studies, and you did something very interesting, it sounds to me. It was about food and agriculture as it's represented in literature.
Yeah, stories about the invention of agriculture, even more niche, but stories about the invention of agriculture as told in late medieval and early modern literature.
And so in a sense, that ticks the box, isn't it, as being something quite niche. Whereas the one thing about Taylor Swift is that you couldn't possibly describe her as niche at the moment. She'd be the if niche has an opposite, it's probably Taylor Swift.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, the way that we work in, you know, in English departments is like you can only study a very small bit of something. And I think that people are starting to identify the small bits of kind of the vast thing that is Taylor Swift that are interesting and that are worthy of study. And people have been publishing on Taylor Swift in celebrity studies and media studies for a while now. But, you know, if I published something on Taylor Swift, it would probably be this thing that I've been thinking about a lot about. There's a certain kind of popular internet quiz that asks you to identify between quotations from Taylor Swift and from Shakespeare. And I would write about that quiz in its different versions. And so I would make it niche, right? It's just not explored yet.
Yeah, so the complexity is in the ambition of the study, not in the fact that we've all Taylor Swift.
I think you could study anything as literature. I mean, that's not to say that everything is sort of equally interesting or will tell you completely the same things, but I think you can approach most things with that kind of patience and interest, and you'll get a lot out of it. I'm not saying that it doesn't matter at all what we teach in universities, because I think it does matter, obviously. And I think it's something that we should be thinking about constantly, is what we think would be worth teaching and studying at universities. But that I think sometimes this kind of reaction really ignores the interesting work that we're asking students to do, which is to try to take on something that they haven't thought of in that way before. And I think right now, the study of Taylor Swift as literature is something that people are excited about and that they haven't thought of in that way.
And it was got rid of by Michael Gove, clear out of what they were considered Mickey Mouse A levels, with general studies and things of that kind. And he wanted to introduce what this term that's often used in education, rigor. And rigor, well, I don't know what the word rigor means to you, but it carries connotations of something really quite difficult. You know? But it's going to be difficult to do. And some will fall by the wayside in the enterprise of rigor. Whereas cultural communications and cultural studies, I remember saying to a class once when I was teaching this subject, well, what you're going to be doing is finding meaning in ordinary things, in teapots and street lamps, in the world around you. In that sense, we shouldn't be afraid of the ordinariness of things, because they're part of our world and we can find meaning in.
And the more that we can approach things with interest rather than fear, the better. Because I think going into studying, you know, Milton, for example, and thinking this is going to be really hard because I don't understand all of the theology and sort of the historical backstory and the politics, you're not necessarily doing yourself a service by approaching it in that way. And so I think I would love if we could sort of present what we do as fun and like easy in some ways. Obviously, you need to pay attention, you need to work, but accessible, I think, because I think it is. I think it's all kind of, we're asking people to do the same tasks with all of these texts, whether it's Paradise Lost or Love Story, is sort of look at it, figure out what's going on, do the research you need to do, and kind of understand how it works.
Yeah, but accessible doesn't mean easy. Accessible means that given the right language and the tools, you can do this. You know, it isn't something which is impossible. It is something you can do. I remember there was an art gallery in Milton Keynes near where I used to live, and they opened up a contemporary art gallery, and they wanted to find out who was coming through the front door. So they did a survey of people who came through the front door, and they found that they were exclusively from certain areas of the town. Contemporary art was from the more prosperous middle-class areas of the town. So they then carried out another piece of research to find out why people didn't come through the front door of the art gallery. And the commonest response was people were afraid that they'd get it wrong. If they came into the gallery, they'd say the wrong thing. In a sense, that's a barrier with a lot of literature, isn't it? You think to yourself, well, I don't want to make a fool of myself by not getting it, by not understanding it.
Definitely. And I totally understand that. You know, they would think I was stupid or something. And I think, the more we can do as teachers, honestly, our classroom's a place where it's okay to get things wrong. I think that's important.
Yeah. And this is something you know about. So now you'd later on give you the confidence to study Shakespeare. But this will give you the tools of looking at language and realizing how language works. So then you can study Shakespeare if you want to or not.
Yeah.
If you want to.
And also, I mean, as I said at the beginning of this interview, to have people realize, at least those who are already kind of deep into, you know, Swiftie fandom, to realize that they're already using a lot of those tools and that they have those tools in their arsenal already. And that is just a matter of kind of adapting to how things are done in an academic setting. But yeah, giving them, as you say, right, giving them confidence to go read other things.
Fan fiction is a genre of its own right. And you examine that with your colleague, Marie. Yeah. And you talk about different forms. And there are things like Buffy, the Vampire Slayer comes up and so on. I mean, is when you write about Taylor Swift, are you writing a kind of fan fiction? Or is it, what's the difference between fan fiction and English literature analysis, basically, is where I'm going.
Well, that's a really good question. Well, fan fiction, I mean, fan fiction is sort of a type of internet kind of prose, usually, that's sort of published on sort of certain like archive sites, like Archive of Our Own. And it's often kind of continuing or stories that already exist or rewriting them with different characters or otherwise responding to them. I think it is really interesting to sort of think about, you know, where does scholarship intersect with fan fiction? And where are we potentially reading things into a text that we just want to be there as opposed to really thinking that they're there, having proof that they're there? I think, you know, a lot of the ways in which we work in English literature are sort of very much sort of set out to try to at least provide a framework for trying to say things that seem reasonable about texts. And one of those things is like trying to separate, you know, the biography of the artist from reading the text itself and finding evidence within the text or sort of otherwise proving what we say, right? Having a footnote saying, this is why I think this, this is who else thinks this. But I think that's a really sort of fascinating question is sort of thinking, We're all providing paratexts to Taylor Swift. And maybe the person writing fan fiction on their computer isn't that different from me, right? I kind of like that way of thinking about it. That feels, in a way, sort of like we're a community of people all sort of having our separate dreams about Taylor Swift.
Yeah. Have you ever encountered anyone in the world of academia who's a bit sniffy, as it were, about you going into the direction of fan fiction and in the direction of Taylor Swift and saying, well, you know, is that something you should be doing, or is the world that's long since gone?
Well, I think that I have met a few people. I assume they're just jealous, but are a little bit more old school and maybe don't care for Taylor Swift, are a little bit skeptical. But I think generally I found my colleagues are very sort of excited about it and interested in how it's going. I think I've gotten a lot of support from my colleagues, so I'm happy about that.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that, really. And as I say, the sniffiness about studying television programs is really, apart from areas of the Daily Telegraph, it's going to be widely accepted these days. Fortunately, I think we're past that idea that there's a very exclusive set of literature beyond which you should not go. I mean, I think I remember there being a debate over studying Harry Potter and whether schools should read Harry Potter. And I was talking to a guest the other day who's a school in the United States. It's a middle school, and they've made the school use the theme of Hogwarts. So across all their subjects, they talk as if they were in Hogwarts, and teachers will take on a role of Mr. Snape and so on, as a way simply of getting the kids to buy into a kind of fictional community they felt a part of. And indeed, it works. Attendance went up and poor behavior went down, apparently. Let's hopefully that
works. Amazing. Well, I look forward to listening to that episode. That sounds really interesting.
One thought, we're nearly ended now, and that is that I remember, again, going back to cultural studies, people would talk. At one time, there was a lot of discussion about Madonna, who maybe in her heyday had a similar sort of impact on our popular culture. Just Taylor Swift. I think nothing quite like this has ever been seen before, really. Maybe the Beatles in the early 60s. But one analysis of Madonna was that she was a kind of, there was a contradictory, paradoxical element to her. She was, on the one hand, a strong woman, a woman of power and ability and so on. On the other hand, she's playing the role of a sort of sexual fantasy as well. And you think, well, Taylor Swift, are you doing that? You know, and in a sense, I was getting earlier about the image of Taylor Swift is difficult to divorce from the honesty and literature of Taylor Swift. To what extent is she producing a product that is, in the end, Taylor Swift's about money and record sales and an awful lot of clever people going, yeah, Taylor, keep on those songs that everyone likes to listen to. Because it's, in the end, it's a machine and it's an industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think we maybe have a sort of image in our heads of what a writer looks like or a poet looks like, right? And I think
they need to be poor.
Yeah. And I think often Taylor Swift is challenging that image. I sort of feel that that's maybe sort of an interesting thing to think about, because again, you know, I think I've found about sort of putting forward the idea that Taylor Swift should be read as literature is that it brings up a lot of sort of preconceptions about what literature is, who an author is. And I think that's interesting to think with and sort of try to figure out what is it about Taylor Swift and everything she represents that might not feel like she's producing important literary texts. But yeah, you've brought up this really interesting point, which is that maybe we expect authors to be poor, and maybe her wealth is sort of getting in the way of, yeah, her almost like her literary greatness being acknowledged or something like that. I'll have to ask my students what they think, I guess.
Well, there is the curse of being the enormous bestseller. If someone writes a book, it's colossally bestseller, then it can't be very good. There's an immediate problem with does popularity taint the artistic merits? Well, you know, I think probably is a problem for Taylor Swift in a sense, because she is a colossal money-making machine as well as writing songs. You aren't making the case for, and I agree with you more than that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of authors have been very successful. I mean, just thinking about Dickens, for example, Shakespeare within his sphere, within London theatre, was respected. But yeah, that's hard to say, because I think it just goes back to this question of who gets held up as worth interpreting and reading in these ways and who doesn't.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure Shakespeare wanted bums on seats in a full house and cared about the revenues at the end of the day as well, had to make a living. So in that sense, or commercialism, you know, there is that as well. If, as we come to an end, what would you say if you try to persuade someone who was rolling their eyes? I don't think you're going to find many people rolling their eyes, but people say, well, I don't think we should be, you know, studying Taylor Swift in school. What would you say were the merits of her songs? What does Taylor Swift do that is Swiftian, not in her sense?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that one of the things that I find very interesting about Swift is just the fact that we're all having this conversation about what should be taught in literature classes because of Swift, and that this is sort of giving rise to this kind of debate over kind of what is literature and how, what is it for? What is the study of it for? Another thing I think is really interesting that I sort of mentioned, I guess, that people are already reading and analyzing her text as literature. And so you're entering into, like you are in a different way with studying, you know, if you show up for a Shakespeare class, you know, at your first year of university, you're kind of entering into, as I mentioned, this ongoing conversation between critics and between other writers and Shakespeare. And with Taylor Swift, you're also entering into this kind of ongoing conversation. It hasn't been going on as long, but it's sort of equally kind of complex and huge. And there are all these sort of things like, you know, bodies of knowledge within it. And in terms of like her songs themselves, I mean, as I said, obviously you can point to anything and say, I could study this as literature, right? I could run a semester long course on this. Probably you would get a lot out of anything doing that. But I think that her work at its most interesting for me is building this network of connections between songs. And they're connections that are very deliberately put there to be close read and analyzed in a way that's anticipating a reading that her fans are doing on the internet, and also the kind of reading we're doing in an English class. And so I think that her work is very deliberately speaking to kind of the English class setting and saying something in itself. Not only is it giving rise to debates about the canon, but it's saying something in itself about like, maybe this is what we should be studied. When she's talking about Wordsworth, when she's rewriting Shakespeare, she's saying, maybe my work should be studied in this way.
Well, thank you, Clea. That is a great place to finish. Believe it or not, our hour has gone by. And I think any teacher listening to this who's coming up to doing Romeo and Juliet, you're missing a trick if you don't use that. So, Clea Doyle, thank you very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed this discussion that finally did happen.
Thank you. Thanks. It was fun.
I've been asking to numerous teachers, academics, and people experienced in education over the last few months. One answer might be to introduce students to the best that can be thought and said. That observation from the 19th century writer Matthew Arnold is often said to express the idea that high culture is the benchmark of English literature and indeed all culture. We have to discriminate between that which is worthy of study and that which isn't. And that, in many ways, has governed what we teach in school, certainly in terms of art and literature and culture. Certain pieces of work, certain forms of art, have stood the test of time. They express a universal appeal, big ideas. They confront what it is to be human. Or they have been constructed in such a way as to inspire admiration for their sheer artistry and craft. Or it might be that from them we can learn important lessons that will guide us in our own lives. It is also sometimes said that great literature shows us how to be great readers, great writers, great thinkers, and explore far more than just the entertainment value of reading a book or watching a play. That's a pretty high bar to set, and has led to all sorts of debates over the years about what is and isn't proper for us to study in schools, what forms part of the canon of English literature, what texts express something about being British, being English, our history, or just being human. It may be possible also that all sorts of literature, not usually considered part of the canon, can serve many of these purposes, and maybe express it in a way that people can find more relevant to their lives. Well, one such artist, contemporary, has yet possibly to stand the test of time, is Taylor Swift, the phenomenon of popular culture. Her songs, if you listen to them, and I have listened to a lot of Taylor Swift lately, certainly aspire, it seems to me, to something more than simple entertainment. But are they art? And are they literature? And are they useful to teachers in schools? Are they, in fact, exactly what you were looking for when you want to interest your English class on a wet afternoon, period 5, English? John Gibbs on Teachers Talk Radio, as I continue to explore what schools are for. With thanks this week to my guest, Dr. Cleo Doyle, lecturer in early modern literature at Queen Mary University, London. You can find more of her work on her website. You can listen to this podcast again on the Podbean site, on Teachers Talk Radio, on Spotify, and many other platforms. Thank you for listening.
Listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.